Hello and welcome to the Irish History Show on Near FM. My name is Cathal Brennan, and if you would like to listen to this or previous episodes of the show, please go to our website, irishhistoryshow.ie. You can follow us on Twitter, at Irish History Pod, or like us on Facebook, facebook.com/The Irish History Show. My co-presenter, John Dorney, recently organised a series of lectures in the Teachers Club in Dublin for the People's College on the theme of Ireland's revolutionary experience of 1916 to 1923 in a world context. Here's the audio of John Dorney's lecture, Ireland in a World of Revolution.
What I'm going to do tonight is I'm going to try to give an overview of Ireland in a world of revolutions. Now, what I mean by this is, we often think of the Irish experience in 1918 to 23, the birth of the Free State, the partition of Ireland. We think of this experience as unique. But in fact, Ireland's experience is really part of a global story, and certainly a European story. The story is that due to the pressures of the Great War, basically, due to other factors, but due to the pressures of the Great War, a host of empires collapsed across Europe and across the wider world. Ireland is only one place where the empire sunders and cracks. Ireland is quite unusual. Ireland is a country on the winning side of the Great War, insofar as Ireland is part of the United Kingdom, where there is nationalist revolution. Normally what happens, the pattern we see across the world, is that a defeated empire breaks up into different parts. State power collapses, new forces, be they national, be they social, be they radical, be they conservative, but new forces rise up and fill the gaps left by the regimes that have fallen. So what I want to do today is place Ireland in this context to set up the talks that we're going to have. And what I also want to do is explain why Ireland is similar to other countries and also why Ireland is different. So among the things I'm going to look at is the Great Revolution, which has its centenary this year. Now, I put 1918, I really meant 1917. The Great Revolution, of course, of this year is the Russian Revolution, the Bolshevik Revolution, which is, among other things, a national revolution in some parts, but is, for the most part, a social revolution. Why don't we have this in Ireland? What's the difference? That's one question. The second question I'm going to look at is, how is Ireland's experience similar to other countries? How is it similar to new nations like Poland, like Czechoslovakia, in Eastern and Central Europe? The third thing I'm going to look at is Ireland's experience of revolution is bloody, but nowhere near as bloody as we see in most other places. And why is this? Why don't we see ethnic cleansing, for example, or genocide as we see in other parts of the world in Ireland? And the last question I'm going to look at is, in Ireland, at the end of this period, we have a new border, but Ireland's not the only place where there's a new border. There are new borders all over the world, really, but one of the most crisis-ridden points of this world, and also in our own world today, is the Middle East. So I'm going to look at these four areas. Now, before I delve into the international comparisons, just a recap, which I'm sure will be familiar mostly to an Irish audience. So the Irish Revolution, which kind of kicks off, according to one interpretation, with the Home Rule crisis, with the disappointed hopes for self-government. Ireland's promised self-rule, doesn't get it. According to another interpretation, it's kicked off by the Easter Rising. The Easter Rising, I want to stress, is in large part a product of the Great War. So before the First World War, we have mobilization in Ireland, we have rival nationalist militias, but we don't have war, we don't have violence. The Easter Rising, in my opinion, the final spark for the Easter Rising is provided by the Great War, by the fact that Ireland is involved in a world conflict, by the fact that in the minds of Irish volunteers, you have to choose between Irish freedom and the British Empire as they see it. There's a guerrilla war in Ireland, 1919 to 21, what we know as the War of Independence between the IRA and British forces. There's the partition of Ireland along ethnic and religious lines in 1921. Now, the date of partition, you can argue it's 1920, the Government of Ireland Act, you can argue it's 1921 with the treaty, or you can argue it's 1922 when the treaty comes into effect. But Ireland is divided. Some people have an issue with the word ethnic. What I mean by ethnic here is there's two nationalities in Ireland, or again, people take issue, but there's two competing claims of nationality in Ireland. There's Irish and British in the simplest way, and there's also the religious factor, there's Catholic and Protestant. And then finally, we have civil war. Now, in my opinion, there are two civil wars in Ireland in 1922 and 1923. The first one is in the north of Ireland. This is a civil war essentially between nationalists and unionists, and it's kind of cut short by the other civil war, which is the civil war over the treaty. Now, most of you will be aware, but because Ireland is not completely independent at the end of this period, because the British have put a number of limits on Irish independence, the treaty is rejected by a lot of the guerrillas of 1919 to 21, and the new government, the Irish Free State government, has to put them down in the Civil War. So this is the Irish experience, which we're very familiar with, but how does it fit into a wider framework? Okay. Well, the first one is Russia. The first and most obvious one is Russia. So again, many of you here will be familiar with the basic facts, but the basic facts are these. The First World War, Russia's military performance has kind of been underestimated by history. It's actually not as bad as people probably think, but Russia loses millions of casualties, and the legitimacy of the Tsarist government is undermined by the First World War. There's other factors as well. There's land hunger, there's social divisions, but really, the key factor is that there's millions of men mobilized to fight the First World War, and the government loses their loyalty. So it's a somewhat different condition from Ireland, but the key common factor is the war. A moderate democratic government in February 1917 takes over under Kerensky, failed to end the war though, couldn't carry the people with it, the people who had basically overthrown the government because they were against the war, because they didn't want to fight the war anymore. And the Bolsheviks, later the Communist Party, took power in October 1917, for many decades afterwards in the communist world, it's known as the Great October Revolution. More recently, historians have called it a coup, I think. Calling it a coup ignores the wider process in Russia, the wider process of radicalization. But what we're looking at here is a great example, in the sense this is people trying to replicate this all over the world, because the Bolsheviks have a great message. The Bolsheviks have the message that we are the future, that not only can we end what they call the imperialist war, not only can we give justice to oppressed nationalities, which they promised to do, but we can bring an end to injustice altogether. They have a great promise of a better future. Another similarity with Ireland is a civil war between whites and between reds. Now the whites have probably been misrepresented over the decades as people who were loyal to the Tsar. That's not really true. The truth is, the whites is everybody but the Bolsheviks. There were people who were on the left who were fighting the Bolsheviks. So parts of the Social Democrats, part of what were called the SORs, the Social Revolutionaries. You have peasants who were afraid that their land would be taken away. But you have famine and mass death. At the end of this period, you have one party ruled by the Bolsheviks. Now, again, there's argument goes back and forth over whether there's one party rule because that's what Lenin, the leader of the Bolsheviks, planned all along, or whether it's under the pressure of civil war. What I want to emphasize here is, look at the commonalities between what happens in Russia and what happens in Ireland, but also look at the differences. The commonalities are, again, I can't stress it enough, the First World War. The First World War puts tremendous pressure on the relationship between governments and people, because the government is asking too much of people in most cases. And almost everywhere, even in the victorious powers, they react. They react in Ireland, for example, in the strike against conscription in 1918, which is a massive factor, in my opinion, even a bigger factor than the Easter Rising and radicalizing people against the British government. And the war is the key factor in the Russian Revolution. Now, civil war follows the Russian Revolution just as surely as it follows the Irish Revolution. It's a far more bloody civil war. It's bloodier by factors of, hundreds of thousands. But it's not surprising that civil war follows revolution, because the competing powers that make revolution, they find a power vacuum, they find a state that needs to be occupied, and they fight over it. Now that's greatly simplifying what happens in Russia, but what I'm trying to say is this is what happens not only in Ireland, not only in Russia, but in a host of other places. I've talked before about the Bolsheviks' message, so this is a classic Bolshevik or communist poster of the era. Workers of the world unite, there's Lenin with the hammer. Germany is kind of the next one to fall. So not many people probably appreciate the German Revolution as an important event as it was, but facing food shortages and an ongoing war, again, the pressures of the war, the Kaiser was overthrown and the German Republic was proclaimed. Now there was a lot of, underhanded politics, in the sense that the way the Republic is proclaimed has a lot to do with the maneuvering of parties into position, the maneuvering of the military, but under pressure of the war, a lot of soldiers simply go home. They refuse to keep fighting. The German Republic is proclaimed. There's an attempted revolution, first by the left, by what's known as the Spartacists, so the left wing of the Social Democratic Party, which is put down. That should say Bavarian, excuse me, there's a typo. There's a Bavarian Social Republic in 1919, which is put down by Freikorps, the right-wing paramilitaries. And there's an attempted coup by the right, the so-called Kapp-Putsch of 1920, which is put down by a general strike. And finally, in 1923, a man you may well have heard of, by the name of Adolf Hitler, attempts what's called the Bierhoff Putsch. The Weimar democracy emerges as a democracy, but for now. Now, I'm not going to go into Germany in detail, but again, let's look at what's common with Ireland. Once again, the fact is the existing state, the empire, is overthrown by the pressures of war. By other things, but overwhelmingly by the pressures of war. The second thing is, the forces which try try to take this place, they fight among themselves. So again, there's differences in all these countries, but we see this as quite a similar thing. We see this in all these countries. Another thing to think about is, in Ireland, we're very familiar with the Black and Tans. Now, the Black and Tans are so notorious in Ireland because they were soldiers introduced as police. They were, if you like, irregular military. They weren't under centralized control. And this is another thing we see after the First World War in many countries. We see these demobilized soldiers. They're recruited into paramilitary squads, sometimes of the left, but usually of the right. The Freikorps were used to put down a left-wing revolution in Germany. They were used also to try to win back territories for Germany that had lost to nationalists in the east of Europe. So the use of irregular military, this is military that's not under the control of the government. They're very often demobilized soldiers, as most of the Black and Tans and the auxiliaries in Ireland were. This is a common thing. We see this in Germany. We see this to a degree in Russia. But we see it in Latvia, in Lithuania, in Poland. Okay. These are not the only places. Hungary briefly has a communist republic led by a man named Béla Kun, which is crushed, actually it's crushed by the surrounding powers, which invade Hungary. But it's the replacement for Béla Kun as leader is a right-wing general known as Admiral Horthy. And Hungary has the distinction of being the only country without a seacoast, which is led by an admiral in the 1930s. But Finland separates from Russia. Now, again, people probably even aren't aware today that Finland was part of Russia, or part of the Russian Empire, the Tsarist Empire, before the First World War. It separates from Russia when the Russian Empire collapses. And immediately, there's civil war. Well, not quite immediately, but in the following months, there's civil war between Reds and Whites. The Reds, of course, the Reds are actually not communists, strictly speaking. The Reds are social democrats. They're put down by a combination of German forces in 1918, and also the Whites, the Finnish anti-communists. And you're left again with an authoritarian government. These civil wars tend again to be a lot more bloody than what happens in Ireland. And in speaking only about the Irish Civil War, the bit where only Irish were fighting Irish, probably the difference is, for all the savagery of the Irish Civil War and the wickedness, the ideological difference between the two Irish factions in 1922 and 1923 was not that great. Now, ideology is a lethal thing, or can be a lethal thing. The fact that people, the so-called Reds, believe that they're fighting for a better world. The fact that the right believed in many cases, and I'm quoting here, I'm not making this up, that the Russian Revolution was the work of Satan. Like, this is a trope of white literature across Europe. So that people believe that they're fighting for almost the end of the world, it greatly increases the viciousness of these conflicts. In Little Finland, which has a smaller population than Ireland at this time, there's 20,000 people killed in this brief civil war, and most of them were killed either in camps or by execution squads. So when we talk about the savagery of the Irish Civil War and how bitter it was, it's important to keep in mind that actually it's relatively restrained compared to some of the violence. So similarities with Ireland, I've already talked about this. The war destroys the state's legitimacy. There's an overthrow of the old undemocratic order. Now, I'm just going to qualify this for Ireland. In Ireland, of course, there were elections before 1914. I call it undemocratic because, and this is not very widely appreciated, about a third of the male population, so about a sixth of the total population, had to vote. And it was never open to Irish people to vote to leave the British Empire. So for me, Ireland is an undemocratic situation. Not as undemocratic as Russia, for example, but for me, undemocratic. However, it has commonality here. The war destroys the state's legitimacy. There's the role of ex-soldiers. Now, in Ireland, this is really less. I mean, ex-soldiers are not very prominent in the IRA, but they're very prominent, in things like the Black and Tans and the auxiliaries, and also in the new quasi-army of Northern Ireland, the Ulster Special Constabulary. There's a point for power between new groups. But the difference is, so the British state did not collapse. A lot of these revolutions that I mentioned there and that I'm going to talk about were really brought on by state collapse. The existing order just collapsed, and in Ireland it didn't. What Irish nationalist revolutionaries, Irish Republicans, are faced with is a well-functioning and powerful state. That's a difference. Second thing is Ireland was more of a democracy. So in 1918, there was almost universal suffrage. I say almost because women over 30 had the vote and subject to a property qualification. So full suffrage comes in Ireland in 1923. In Ireland, as I said, ex-soldiers are not really the backbone. And Ireland, as I've mentioned already, Ireland's civil wars were much less bloody. So 5,000 dead, and excuse me, I said 20,000, as many as 40,000 dead in Finland. Okay. Finishing this kind of segment of the talk, why wasn't there a class war in Ireland? So it's not because there was no poverty in Ireland, it's far from it. I mean, Ireland ends this period at the end of the Irish Civil War with a famine. You know, it's not a famine where there's mass mortality, but it's a famine where emergency food aid has to be shipped to parts of the west of Ireland, places like Donegal. It's not the case that there was no class warfare in Ireland. So we see here in the picture, this is from Bury, I think, in Limerick. Workers, Soviet mills. We make bread, not profits. There were Soviets set up in Ireland. And it's not the case that there was no land hunger. So why wasn't there a class war? Well, one reason is the land question was partly settled in Ireland. Now, this is often exaggerated, but because there were many people who still paid rent to landlords in the traditional way, and it's not wound up until 1923 with the new Land Act. But the British Land Acts, starting in the 1880s and really culminating in the 1908 Act, had enabled tenants to buy out the landlord. So the land hunger is not as intense, for example, in Ireland as it is in Russia. So land for the people is a massive slogan of Lenin and Bolsheviks in Russia. It can't be such a big slogan for Sinn Féin, although they do use that slogan. Organised labour in Southern Ireland is mainly pro-Republican, but on the whole, it's socially moderate. So the likes of William O'Brien, Thomas Johnson, people who led the labour movement in Ireland, they were not revolutionaries. They were social democrats. They backed the Treaty of 1922. They backed the Free State. Although they sometimes made noises in support of the Russian Revolution and so forth, they're really not revolutionaries, the leadership of the labour movement. Now, the Soviets in class warfare, this could almost be a lecture in itself, because many people don't know about this. But for example, in the first half of 1922, at the time when the British are leaving and the Free State is about to be set up, you have a Soviet movement across the centre, the mid-centre of Ireland, and centred around Tipperary and County Limerick, and mostly in the creameries there. And they have all the rhetoric of communism. They call themselves Soviets, they run up the red flag. And also, if you look at the kind of the language of labour relations at the time, it's extremely antagonistic. You know, the union organisers talk about we're going to fight against the capitalists, we're going to scrap against the capitalists, as one organiser in County Cavan, whose speech I happened to read, once said. I won't say it's all talk, but it's more talk than action. So when people proclaim a Soviet, it's usually because their wages haven't been paid because of the agricultural crisis and the creameries, and they proclaim a Soviet because it's the most radical thing that you can do. It's really, you know, an occupation strike is what's going on. But how at the end of this period, the so-called Soviets, the land occupations, and the other manifestations of public radicalism were put down by the Irish Free State. There was even a special part of the army, which was known as the Special Infantry Corps, that was used to put it down. So to say that there was no class war in Ireland is not completely true, but there wasn't to the extent that there was in other places. And the defining reason, I think, why this was the case was Ireland was a nationalist revolution. Okay, so should we look, therefore, to new nation states if we want to look for places that are more similar to Ireland? Now, looking at our map here, in the map on the left here is Europe in 1914. Now, we can see if you look to the right of France, we have four great empires. You have the German Empire, you have the Austro-Hungarian Empire, or the Habsburg Empire, and you have the Russian Empire, the Tsarist Empire, and to the bottom right of the screen, the Ottoman Empire. All four of these empires fall before the First World War, in this process that I'm talking about, where states collapse under the strain of war. And what replaces them, for the most part, is new nation states. Now, let's start with Russia. So moving from right to left, we see the top, there's Finland, which is a new nation state anyway. We see Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, the Baltic states, they emerge from the Russian Empire. We see Belarus, which is briefly independent. Now it gets cut off in 1921. We see Ukraine, again, briefly independent. It's crushed towards the end of the Russian Civil War. But the lasting one is Poland. Poland re-emerges, having been partitioned between three countries before the war. We see Czechoslovakia, which is an altogether new invention. We see Yugoslavia, again, it's a new invention. It's basically, at this time, it's more like Greater Serbia. In fact, I think the original name is the Kingdom of the Serbs, Croats, and something else. Slovenes, excuse me. And Romania is massively expanded in size. Now, I'm going to talk a little bit later about further east in the Ottoman Empire. But that's enough. These are enough examples to talk about. There are a lot of new nations. Their experience is like Ireland in some ways, but unlike in other ways. The main difference is, as I said, whereas the empire Ireland is part of wins the war and is strong, the empires that these countries are part of just collapse. So Poland was a country divided into three, divided between Germany, Austria, and Russia, resurrected in 1918. Now, this is unlike Ireland. The Irish revolutionaries have to fight through political means, through military means, to make their state. In Poland, the state collapses. Russian soldiers who had been in the various armies, and also some Russian soldiers who had been prisoners of war in the French army, return to Poland, and with their aid, Polish nationalists proclaim a Polish republic. Now, also unlike Ireland, Ireland has the advantage in some ways of being an island, being isolated. Poland is surrounded by countries which also want some of this territory. Poland fights four wars. Some of the wars, Poland is, we could say, the aggrieved party in the sense that it's invaded. So it's invaded by the new Soviet Republic. It's not called the USSR yet. It fights off the Soviet Republic in 1920, but it also fights wars with Ukraine. One of the things that's probably not appreciated today in the situation in Eastern Europe is the vicious animosity between Poles and Ukrainians. So although Poland might appear to be, at the moment, sympathetic towards Ukraine because they're anti-Russian, actually there's a deep vein of animosity there. It starts off here and it gets actually worse in the Second World War. But Czechoslovakia, also, which is certainly the aggrieved party here, fights and loses a short war with Poland in this period. And Poland emerges as an authoritarian democracy. So if we think of something like we see in Turkey today under Erdogan, where there are formal elections, but where the real power lies with the strong man, is what Poland ends up with. It ends up with Marshal Piłsudski. Piłsudski has a mixed press, so he's authoritarian, but he stands for some good things. He stands for ethnic toleration. He stands for an open-minded version of Polishness. But probably, again, closer in some ways to Ireland is Czechoslovakia. Now, Czechoslovakia today is two countries. It's the Czech Republic and Slovakia. It's a union of Czechs and Slovaks. What's similar to Ireland? Well, they peacefully announce that there's a new state, Czechoslovakia. Thomas Masaryk, in a way that's reminiscent of the Irish Dáil of 1919. So remember, violence in Ireland comes after. Now, unlike Ireland, Czechoslovakia doesn't have the Austrian Empire to deal with because it's just gone. They send representatives to the peace conference at Versailles and elsewhere. And unlike Ireland, where the delegates from the Irish Republic were not let in, the delegates from Czechoslovakia are recognised. So Czechoslovakia becomes a new country with the consent of the great powers and remains a democracy until 1939 and German invasion. Now, for this reason, Czechoslovakia is sometimes seen as a great success story. Czechoslovakia is not without its problems. And one of the biggest problems, which I'm going to talk about now, is minorities. So Czechoslovakia, the end of Czechoslovakia, of course, comes when the Germans invade, ostensibly to protect the German minority. But they protect the German minority in Sudetenland. Again, the commonalities, state collapse. Poland is much more violent than Ireland, but Czechoslovakia is more peaceful. The minorities, now, whereas minorities are things that collapse states elsewhere, they don't collapse in Ireland. Why? Well, the Free State really has a small minority. It starts off with about 10% of a Protestant minority. Now, not all Protestants are even Unionists. They're not so distinct in culture and language as minorities are elsewhere. Second thing is, in Poland, there are up to a third minority. So it's about, you know, it's about 70% ethnic Polish. And then there's Germans, there's Jews. Now, Jews in this context means not only a religious group, but also an ethnic group, because these Poles spoke Yiddish or so, or were only learning Polish for the first generation, and Ukrainians. And Czechoslovakia has large German and also Hungarian populations. Ireland, it's a bad thing to say, but in some respects, it's kind of lucky that its minority is relatively small and relatively powerless. These are things that collapse new nation states elsewhere. Okay, moving on to the third part of my talk. So we've talked already about the subject of violence, and particularly about, I want to particularly address ethnic cleansing and genocide, and particularly in the Ottoman Empire, which is the place where it's most severe. It happens in other parts of Europe, but it's most severe in the former Ottoman Empire. The late historian Peter Hart referred to the Irish Revolution as part of the unmixing of peoples, in the sense that the Catholic nationalist South separated from the Protestant Unionist North. But the violence and the trauma of this rupture is nothing compared to what happened elsewhere. So the Ottoman Empire technically was a Muslim caliphate, so a word we're sadly familiar with again in a very different context. It's about 25% Christian, and it's very multi-ethnic. So although it's technically the leader of all world's Muslims, actually there are many different faiths, there are many different ethnicities there. But the Ottoman Empire sees the worst violence, of which the worst example is the Armenian Genocide. The Armenian Genocide comes about because the Armenian minority is accused of helping Russia during the war. Now, recent evidence tends to show that the Armenian guerrillas really were helping Russia. It's a very fraught debate that I'm not going to enter into because, if you acknowledge that there were Armenian guerrillas fighting on Russia's side, it appears to excuse what the Ottomans did, which is not my intention. But essentially what happens is, it was an executive order issued for the deportation of all Armenians away from the border with Russia and towards central Syria. In the region of 1.5 million Armenians died in these forced marches into what's now Syria. There's nothing remotely comparable with this in the Irish experience. Now, the Turkish Republic comes out of the war. I'll try to deal with this as briefly as I can, but whereas the Ottoman Empire is a Muslim caliphate, the Turkish Republic is a nation state for Turks. There's a big difference. Turkey also, at its origin, has to fight invading powers. So because it's a defeated power, it's actually occupied by France, by Britain, and latterly by Greece. Ataturk, who becomes the leader of the Turkish Republic, fights and expels the Greeks, which is the last major force in Turkey. But one of the great casualties of this is the Greek population of Turkey. The Greeks have been in what's now Turkey since classical days. They were Greeks in the sense, not so much that they spoke the Greek language, but that they were Orthodox Greek Christians. And as many as 400,000 are killed at the end of this process, and another million driven out of the Turkish Republic to Greece. And reciprocally, Greece, which had tried to take Constantinople, which had tried to carve up Turkey, but which then expels 350 Muslim Turks. So again, Turks, not so much in the sense that they spoke the Turkish language, but the sense that they were Muslim and therefore identified as Turks, were deported to Turkey. So what we see here, there are cases in Ireland, for example, of people who end up on the wrong side of the border, of people who are driven out of their homes, people who are killed for their religion, but nothing remotely on this scale. Okay. What we see on the left here is one of the forced marches of Armenians, and what we see on the right is the city of Smyrna, which is now Izmir in Turkey, which was a predominantly Greek city, and that's in flames after it was set alight by Turkish troops. In Ireland, by contrast, so we have states, and they're states which are built on a, if you like, an ethno-religious group, Catholic and Nationalist, Protestant and Unionist. How does the violence compare? Well, in the Irish Free State, around 41,000 Protestants left in 1922. So this is not negligible. People debate how many were driven out because of violence. There's certainly a large fall in the southern Protestant population, which is a fall of 106,000 between 1911 and 1926. But if we look at this has prompted some people to compare what happens in Ireland to what happens, for example, in the Ottoman Empire or elsewhere. And for me, there's no comparison. When we look at the level of violence in the Free State, there is violence against Protestants, for example, particularly in the early months of 1922, when the British are leaving, when the Free State is not really established. But it doesn't begin to compare with the violence elsewhere. It's not state-sanctioned, it's not organized. The Free State promised to, and for the most part, it did protect the lives and the properties of southern Protestants. Northern Ireland has a worse record, but not so much worse that it can begin to be compared with what happens in Eastern Europe or in the Ottoman Empire. So the Catholic minority is much larger than in the south of Ireland. So the Northern Catholics certainly suffered more violence than Southern Protestants. So we're looking at about 330 civilians killed, 800 wounded, according to one study. Certainly in the new Northern Ireland, they're discriminated against by gerrymandering. Gerrymandering is, of course, drawing new boundaries to underrepresent their numbers by electoral rigging. James Craig, the Prime Minister of Northern Ireland, famously says it's a Protestant state for a Protestant people. But if Northern Ireland was so terrible, if it could be compared with what happens to, for example, the Greeks, or what happens to the Armenians, or even what happens to Poles and Ukrainians on the wrong side of that border, you should be looking at a massive outflux, if that's a word, exodus, of Catholics from Northern Ireland, and you don't see that. Only about 2% of the Northern Catholic population leaves. The ones that leave in 1922 because of violence, a lot of them actually drift back afterwards. So we do see restraint in Ireland, although these are refugees from Belfast and Dublin in 1922. A lot of them were unfortunate enough to be housed, not unfortunate enough to be housed in the square, but unfortunate enough to be housed here in Parnell Square when the Irish Civil War broke out, when they were in the middle of hostilities. But why was there less violence in Ireland? Well, there's less overall violence. Now, one reason for this is not so much the restraint of Irish participants, but the fact that there isn't international intervention. So when you have great powers intervening in civil wars, there are studies which say the death toll goes up by a factor of 3, and I certainly believe this. Ireland benefited from a greater tradition of the rule of law. Now, if you think about this, what I mean by this is the Irish Free State, for example, and Northern Ireland inherit the British tradition where each citizen has equal rights, where the authorities can't break the law. Now, while there are exceptions to this, both in the British Empire and in the new Irish states, generally speaking, this is respected. So the Free State, for example, protects the property and lives of Protestants. Why? Because it's according with the law. And, you know, that might be seen as glib or as utopian, but I think it's a real factor. An ideology of civic belonging, similarly, the Irish Free State, for example, Irish nationalist revolutionaries generally say things like, our Protestant fellow countrymen, we welcome Protestants into the Free State. They're often hypocritical. They often then talk about the religion of the Irish people as Catholicism. But there is an ideology of civic belonging where all the people in the country belong to the country. And finally, simply less cultural difference. Now, the difference between Irish Protestants and Irish Catholics culturally is fairly minimal at this point. Whereas there's some differences in things like habits and sport and accents, there's very little difference in terms of language or in terms of, except for parts of Belfast, in terms of segregation of areas in most of Ireland. Okay, moving on. This is kind of the final point I want to hit in this talk, which is the Middle East. We think of the Middle East as a constant zone of conflict. It wasn't necessarily like this before the 20th century, though. And the main reason is probably the breakup of the Ottoman Empire and the way that it broke up. So we can see the Ottoman Empire in 1914. Once upon a time, the Ottoman Empire stretched into Central Europe. At this point in time, it's restricted to east of Constantinople or Istanbul, as it was just about to be renamed. Now, after the First World War, what do we see? Well, we see the Turkish Republic, the newly named Turkish Republic. We see the new states of Syria and Iraq. We see the Mandate of Palestine, which is most of which is today's Israel, some of which is the Palestinian Authority. We see the new state of Transjordan, today's Jordan, and we see Saudi Arabia. How did these come about? Well, like Ireland, there was new borders drawn in the map. Unlike Ireland, they generally did not reflect ethnic or religious divisions. So, I'll come back to that at the end. So, one of the most famous manifestations is the Balfour Declaration. Now, I should say, actually, before I continue, what causes the carve-up of the Middle East in the way that it was carved up is not so much the wishes of the people, not so much the wishes of indigenous revolutionaries as it was in Eastern and Central Europe, but because the great powers, specifically Britain and France, carved up the Middle East. Now, one of the most famous manifestations is the Balfour Declaration, where the British government promised in 1916, I think, the land of Palestine as a homeland for the Jews, without prejudice to the rights of the Arab inhabitants, kind of having your cake and eating it. As we know, that didn't work out that well. But this is only one example of the tinkering of the great powers in the Middle East. Now, this here is the Sykes-Picot Agreement. Now, actually, it's the Sykes-Picot and the Russian diplomat whose name escapes me at the moment, agreement, because the Blue Zone was supposed to be Russian zone of occupation after the war. The Light Blue Zone was the French zone of occupation. This one is direct British control, and this is British influence. It's not quite adhered to after the war, but basically what the great powers decide before the end of the war, 1916, is to divide up the zone of the Ottoman Empire into different spheres of influence from themselves. Now, two states which are at war today in Iraq are Iraq and Syria. Excuse me, in the Middle East are Iraq and Syria. To take Iraq first, Iraq is three Ottoman provinces. It's the province of Mosul, the Vilayet in Turkish, of Mosul, of Baghdad, and of Basra. And these provinces are almost coterminous with the ethnic or religious divisions in Iraq today between Shia Arab, Sunni Arab, and Kurd. At that time, Mosul is mostly Kurdish. That's not true today. So the British set up this new state of Iraq, and there's nothing in particular to make it a nation. Mosul, for example, in the north of Iraq, had previously had most of its commerce and kind of cultural interaction with Aleppo, which, as we know, was in the north of Syria. Syria, similarly, is sliced off by the French. And again, there's three different Ottoman provinces. There's a province associated with Aleppo, the governorate of Aleppo. There's the one there's the one connected with Damascus, and there's another one in the south. And furthermore, in the zone that's known as Greater Syria, there's what we know as Palestine, and there's also what we know today as Lebanon. Lebanon is hived off by the French as a homeland for the Maronite Christians. So immediately after the war, the French military establishment certainly was quite right-wing, quite on the conservative end of things. They identified with the legacy of the Crusades, and they hoped to establish a Christian homeland in the Middle East. But the Kurds were promised a state, actually, ironically enough, even as early as this, and the Kurds, of course, never got a state, and are still fighting for it today. Now, the effects today, I hardly mean to say, but the Israeli-Palestine conflict, which we're all aware of, states with little sense of nationhood, Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon, with constant internal conflict, the monarchies of Saudi Arabia and Jordan. Now, just a word on this. So, in the carve-up of the Middle East, there had been some indigenous guerrillas, which, you know, in the West, we're familiar with to a very vague extent from film like Lawrence of Arabia. What this was a revolt of, if you like, tribal Arabs from the Arabian Peninsula for the most part, which the British co-opted, which played a minor part in winning the war. The British founded a number of monarchies based on this. They founded a monarchy in Iraq, which was originally a monarchy, and also in what they knew as Transjordan, with the Hashemite dynasty. They wanted to put the Hashemite dynasty in power in Saudi Arabia. They were defeated by the Saud family, which was a religiously extreme family. But these monarchies, again, they have little legitimacy. The Saud family is in Saudi Arabia because of their defeat in the factional conflict of the Hashemite family. The monarchy in Jordan is there because the British put it there, has no particular reason otherwise to be there. And a portion of people, for example, the Kurds, are across four countries, so Iraq, Iran, Syria, and Turkey. And we see here ISIS. We don't believe in the Sykes-Picot Agreement. This is as they're demolishing the frontier between Iraq and Syria. What does this have to do with Ireland? Well, In Ireland, we have a border, and Ireland shows, again, to a lesser extent probably, the dangers of drawing borders, and the dangers both of dividing and uniting people, in the sense of dividing people between what was then the Irish Free State and Northern Ireland, but also of uniting people who don't want to necessarily live together. So in the north of Ireland, without suggesting any simple solutions, but in the north of Ireland, you have a large minority from the start who don't want to be there. And this is echoed across Europe, but most powerfully in the Middle East. And that's why we see so much, one of the reasons really why we see so much violence in the Middle East today. Now, okay, so to recap what I've told you, Ireland's revolutionary experience is part of a global theme. It's part of a theme of empires collapsing, it's new forces emerging, be they nationalists, be they socialists. It's a period of great violence. So the 4,000 to 5,000 who died in Ireland after the First World War are part of hundreds or millions of thousands of people who died in what are sometimes called the wars after the war. And I hope today that I've given you some aspect or some inkling of how Ireland fits in. Okay, thank you very much, and I'm happy to take your questions.
Thank you very much for listening. If you'd like to listen to this or previous episodes of the show, please visit our website, irishhistoryshow.ie. Follow us on Twitter at Irish History Pod, or like us on Facebook, facebook.com/The Irish History Show. And we really appreciate all the support from all the people who are listening. If you want to share any of the episodes with your friends on social media, Facebook, Twitter, anything like that, we really appreciate it too. Thank you.